This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and Chris Prytower.
The U.S. increases tariffs on $200 billion of Chinese goods by 25%, and the U.S. stock market suffered its worst losses for the year with five straight down days of trading as U.S. Treasury yields dropped to 2.43%. Commodities also falling along with stocks this week. Hi, everyone. I'm Chris Sheridan, and welcome to this week's Financial Sense News Hour. Joining us in Hour 1 is John Kosar of Asbury Research, and John believes the market is at a key inflection point, but long-term, his indicators are still pointing to higher stock prices. Also, later on in the program, Joe Dancy says the big boys are moving into the Permian Basin, and they are doing so in a very big way. This week, Occidental Petroleum won out and beat Chevron for its bid for Devon Energy, and Joe sees a lot more bullish signs for oil moving forward. And of course, Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about what moved the markets. All of that coming up in Hour 1.
This week was about two things: profit-taking and a technical posture that has finally changed on this market, and secondly, headline risk. The S&P 500 closed at new all-time highs on a closing basis last week, and basically, you know, just been a straight shot up from the December lows for a 25% gain in just over 4 months. For that rate of change to continue, the market would basically be up 100% by the end of this year, so it's not quite sustainable. That's a tough thing. So technicians and strategists have all been talking about a congestion time. Actually, we've been hearing those comments since February, even here on the show from some of our interviewees. And it's finally here, you know, in the way of a 3% dip so far off of a tweet that was heard around the world Sunday night. And that's where I'll go into talking about the headline risk part right here. So Sunday, President Trump tweeted, and I quote, "The trade deal with China continues, but too slowly, as they attempt to renegotiate." No, you know, an exclamation. And then Trump tweeted after that, the 10% will go up to 25% on Friday, meaning the percentage tariff on around $200 billion in Chinese goods. And then he said $325 billion of additional goods sent by China remain untaxed, but will be shortly at a rate of 25%. Immediately, the Dow Jones Industrial Average futures fell 450 points overnight, which was about 1.7% at the time. Now, Trump doubled down on Monday morning and tweeted, "The United States has been losing for many years $600 to $800 billion a year on trade. With China, we lose $500 billion of those dollars. So sorry, we're not going to be doing that anymore." Interestingly, there was a buy-the-dip mentality that almost recovered all of the losses on Monday. However, on Tuesday, de-risking continued due to trade rep Lighthizer shedding more light on details such that China had reneged on parts of the agreement they thought were already committed and cemented. And the selling in the early part of the week was very broad-based and very indiscriminate. Finally, a couple times this week, the stock market did rally on hopes of a deal. On Wednesday, Trump tweeted that Chinese Vice Premier Li Qiu was coming to make a deal, to which he said, "We'll see." Thursday, Trump said he had an excellent alternative to a Chinese trade deal, without specifics, but I think we can all assume he means tariffs. And also on Friday, Treasury Secretary Mnuchin said negotiations were constructive, which really translates to ongoing. Now, Trump also tweeted Friday he's in no rush to make a deal and feels very comfortable to allow the higher tariffs to remain and hope that the Chinese will negotiate. All in all, what's clear is that the trade deal one investor thought was in the bag just a month ago is still uncertain. So we're telling clients to expect some headline volatility in the near term, and we aren't so confident that deal is accomplished anytime soon. Technically, I've seen some buying interest just under the 50-day moving average, and that's good to see for the S&P 500. It's good to see that we're able to hold up a little bit on this dip, but if fears escalate that these new tariffs could add to economic weakness for China, and then, of course, that can be construed for global growth, that could lead the market lower. My own thoughts on the matter is that we're asking too much for the Chinese, such as changing their laws. They're not going to succumb to some other sovereign nation telling them how how to run their laws. So most likely what we'll do is get a response from China, I don't know how soon again, that they may agree to make certain purchases like they have over the past year to help reduce the budget deficit. My guess is that's really a soft trade that we could see happen. So where things left off on trade this week, tariff rates increased from 10% to 25% on $200 billion of Chinese imports, and it looks like Trump is planning, he hasn't done it yet, another 25% on the rest, which is essentially $325 billion of imports being made. On another note, Uber released its initial public offering on Friday. I don't know if you guys remember, Lyft did not go so well because it was priced for perfection. And so Uber came in lower on the scale of what many were expecting it at $45 a share. Basically, I saw the shares trading mostly around that on Friday. At $45, that values the company at around $75.5 billion. Now, the CEO said on CNBC they wanted to take a conservative approach, obviously in the wake of Lyft's IPO last month, and also, of course, from all the market weakness this week. So pretty much that's it for me, Chris. Expect continued market volatility on headline risk and watch the technical setups like that 50-day moving average for the S&P 500. It wasn't likely with this strong of a trend that we would break that on the first go, but it does appear vulnerable to profit taking at this time.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. That features interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's what you missed.
But I don't see that be the end of the world. The Chinese will probably going to come up with physical monetary stimulus, propping up growth back up again. Be careful. Again, just want to put this whole thing into proper perspective. The total Chinese export to the United States account for about 4% of the Chinese GDP. So in the event of a full-blown trade war, that 4% of GDP is not going to be completely wiped out. It probably going to wipe out a big chunk of it, let's say 30 or 40% of that due to the higher tariffs. So it is a significant shock. We're talking about a 1 or 2 percentage point of GDP hit to the Chinese economy. That's a very big shock, but they have the ability and the run room to come up with physical and monetary stimulus to make that up. There's no question in my mind. They can do that reasonably easily because of the huge accumulative savings remains very, very high. So that's why I think it probably be a transitional period in that worst case scenario. But if this threat is just a threat, deja vu 2016 remain to be my baseline story.
Everyone wants to retire well. That's not as easy as it sounds. You need to make the right investment choices, decide when to take Social Security, plan for taxes on your retirement income, and create a legacy for your family. To retire well, you need a roadmap to help you get there. Let Financial Sense Wealth Management help you navigate your way to retirement. We provide comprehensive, thoughtful, and personal retirement planning. Call Financial Sense Wealth Management now at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. Start your journey to retiring well today. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, one of the big stories this week is the takeover of Devon, with bids coming from Chevron and Occidental. Chevron, on the day we're doing this interview on a Thursday, backed out of the deal. Will more acquisitions be hitting the shale patch, as many of these companies don't make money and the big boys are moving us in? Joining me on the program is Joe Dancy. He's Associate Director at SMU McGuire Energy Institute. Joe, let's begin with what's going on in the shale patch. I think last month, shale production hit 12.3 million barrels. But Joe, as I take a look at a lot of these companies that are producing, and I'm talking about some of these mid-tiered companies, a lot of these companies still aren't in positive cash flow. So there's one thing. The second thing that we've seen over the last year is you got the big boys moving in. Exxon has moved into shale. Chevron is there. They're big. You've got Occidental Petroleum, which just won the, or at least temporarily, the takeover for Devon. You've got Royal Dutch in the area. So let's talk about the shale patch. You've got the EIA saying they're going to be producing 15, 20 million barrels a day. How realistic is this?
Yeah, good question, Jim. You know, it's interesting. You look at the statistics from the EIA for 2019, and, you know, we have record oil production, record natural gas production, record natural gas liquids production, and things, you know, look like they're going gangbusters. But you and I have been around long enough. You remember back in peak oil, M. King Hubbard said essentially we would peak, and we actually, his predictions in 1956 came true. In the 1970s, we actually have peaked with conventional production. But as you know, the unconventional, we actually fell from 10 million in the 70s to 5 million barrels per day in the 2000s, and have are back up, you know, well over 10 million barrels per day, but all of it's unconventional. The thing that's very interesting, and the reason Chevron and all these big players and Warren Buffett and everybody are jumping in, is a lot of the play for unconventional is really focused on the Permian Basin. And the reason for that, it's sort of interesting, Jim. I mean, the East Texas oil field that made the Hunt's fortune and made the Murchison's fortune and the Bass's in Fort Worth, you know, essentially, it's pretty well depleted now. It was 6 billion barrels. I mean, it's the largest conventional oil field in the lower 48. Prudhoe Bay is like 10 billion barrels of crude oil. From what the estimates have been rolling out of the USGS and some other people, essentially, they think the Permian Basin alone is going to be like 18 to 20 billion barrels. Now, Lord knows, Jim, if we're going to get that. You know, it all depends partly on technology, et cetera. But when you look at activity, there's a lot of areas in the United States that most of the activity is actually relatively slow. Like Michigan, believe it or not, had a 100-year low for permitting. Ohio, Pennsylvania, and West Virginia, because all natural gas oriented. So where these big players are looking, and you're exactly right, the shale players, well, number one, the shale players, if you're in the natural gas, there's not much interest in it. A lot of companies are having financial difficulties. But even in the oil, which if you run the cash flow models is where you want to be, even in the oil, the main place where the parties want to go is the Permian Basin, because that's where the economics are. Now, whether, you know, you go forward and you look at talking to people, there's been a lot of money. I mean, a lot of money that's been invested in the leasehold out there and drilling. The amount of value, I guess, per acre on a leasehold basis or on a mineral basis has just gone astronomical. And it's interesting, Jim, you know, when you put all these numbers into your cash flow model, as you know, there's a lot of smaller players that, you know, they're not making money right now. And I know and I talk to my students, and we do basic cash flow models for essentially the law students and the business students, and show them how sensitive those models are to prices and oil prices, because that's essentially what you're getting in the Permian Basin. And you know, right now, you can make an argument there are some profitable areas. There's still some unprofitable areas. But you know, when oil's at $50 or $45 a barrel, you know, everybody was losing money. And I think going forward, you know, the amount of capital, as you know, to develop these, I mean, you're talking $10 million a well, or, you know, it includes completion, the gathering systems, and the leasehold, et cetera, the all-in cost. You just don't drill one well, you drill 50 or 100 of those wells. And the players that need to play there are the big players, and the reserves going forward, that's the Permian Basin is where you're playing. So it's interesting when you, and I deal with my students looking for jobs, et cetera, you know, most of the companies, if they're hiring, you know, they tell me, you know, it's the Permian Basin where they're playing. They're not, you know, North Dakota's drilling, but they're not super hot like they used to be. Colorado's not the, and it's not only the Texas part of the Permian Basin, both the Midland Basin and the Delaware Basin, but it's also New Mexico is really, really hot. Actually, New Mexico has really jumped way up on the oil production charts because of all the Delaware Basin wells that are going in out there. So, now, Jim, well, where this goes, you know, this might be, the problem I have when you analyze this, I'm sort of, your question is, well, are we going to see more deals? is I thought we're going to see more deals the last 2 or 3 years. Because, I mean, you go out there and, you know, as values kept going up and up, you figure, well, someone's going to jump in now because they can see the trends. There's enough physical data out there when you drill these wells and enough decline curve analysis and enough engineers to figure things out that, you know, they would have jumped in 3 years ago and made the offer versus wait till today when, you know, oil prices are higher, the technology is higher, and I assume the mineral values are higher if you're buying minerals. So going forward, I expect there'll be more activity, and it might not be quite on the scale we've seen. And I also know there's quite a few private venture companies out there that raise some venture capital. And one way, obviously, you have an exit strategy, as you know, being in the finance business, you have an exit strategy, you develop, and then you know, part of the exit strategy is you sell to a bigger player who can develop for you. And I expect to see more deals, you know, going forward. But then again, Jim, I've been wrong the last 3 years. So Lord knows, I hope I know what I'm talking about.
Well, you know, it's interesting, Joe, is same thing happens in the mining industry, whether you're looking at gold companies. They go on the acquisition binge when prices are rising. The minute that prices start falling, of course, with falling prices, also falling stock prices, and then all of a sudden they get cautious. So we saw a nice run-up after a 40% steep decline in the fourth quarter. We got oil prices up to 66. But Joe, let's talk about the price of oil now. It's pulled back from its 66 level. We're down around 62. Some say we could go down, if you look at charts, the technicians are saying we could go down to 55, 56, which is an area where a lot of companies just can't make money. But we have a couple other things going on. We still have the OPEC production cuts, and it looks like they're adhering to them, especially Saudi Arabia. We've got the Iranian oil sanctions that are supposed to go into effect in May, although the Iranians are saying if they can't sell the oil, they're going to back out of their nuclear agreement. You've got Venezuelan oil production that at one time was at close to 3 million barrels. It's now below 1 million barrels. So you got Venezuela. You have problems in Libya and Nigeria. You have the Iranian sanctions. You have OPEC cuts. So those are sort of the negatives on the supply front. On the positive side, you've got U.S. shale production now. The U.S. has become the number one oil producer in the world. But one of the things I think a lot of our listeners may not understand, and they don't hear this from the media, the U.S. is not energy independent. We still import a lot of oil into this country. We're not as large as we used to. China is the number one importer. So given this backdrop, as you look at oil going forward, give me the positives and the negatives for the price of oil. I see a lot of positives. I do see some negatives with shale production, or let's say OPEC does not adhere to those production cuts. But give me the positives and negatives for oil going forward, because I know in the shale play, the little guys cannot make money if you get down to a $55 oil price.
Yeah, it's interesting. I guess that one of the positives, you talk to Dan Steffens quite a bit, and I swap notes. He actually lectures in my class from time to time. One of the positives, I mean, this is positive all the time, is essentially with the economy growing, you're going to use 1 to 1.5 to 2 million more barrels per day every year of oil. You know, and it's interesting, and this is very disturbing to me. And I you know, with my students come in, they are all been brainwashed, Jim. And I use that term, and it's not the proper term, but they come in and they think we're moving to a non-oil based economy. And I tell them, and I show them the charts and say, look, year after year after year, we're using more oil, we're using more natural gas, we're using more coal globally. Of course, the U.S., we're actually have cut back a little bit on coal, but regardless, globally, we're using more and more of this stuff. So there is going to be an industry going forward. We can't totally electrify and use none of those items. So demand is going to be there going forward. We are not going to a post-carbon economy anytime soon. What's going to surprise, this is my sort of surprise prediction, and I'm glad you're having me on because it's been a while. What I'm hearing when I go out, and I've been out to Midland and gone around with some of the producers out there, what they have is quite a few of what they're called these drilled and uncompleted wells. And During the last couple of years, Jim, as you know, the pipeline capacity to get the oil and the gas out of the Permian Basin, they've been constrained. They have too many wells and too much fluid to get out. They are just now completing some of those pipelines, and what they're going to do, because you don't want to complete a well that you've drilled if it's going to sit for 2 years while you're trying to get pipeline capacity. So now, as we're getting pipeline capacity coming on this summer, a lot of companies are going to go out and they want to frack their wells. And they're going to have two problems. And the number one problem is going to be water, because water is difficult to source out there and to get it. But even if you can get the water, what has happened in the last year or 6 months, there's been a whole bunch of employees laid off at these completion companies. And so when you call up and say, hey, I want you to come in and frack my 10 drilled and uncompleted wells, you're going to get, hey, we don't have the equipment, we don't have the people. And I tell you, when you lay people off in Midland, Texas, you know, unless you're from Midland, Texas, those people aren't going to stick around to wait to get rehired a year or two from now. And actually, a couple of the people were joking with me and said, God, Joe, if, you know, you want to come out and you want to sit on one of our completion crews, we'll pay you $100,000 a year. And it's not as exciting as being a professor, but, you know, you'll be out here in Midland, you'll be in the outdoors, and we got plenty of work to do. But they expect, these experts or service company, they expect the number of completion crews and companies to be available to fall substantially short of the demand from these operators who want their wells completed. And part of it's an economic argument too, Jim. You don't want to complete a well and let it sit there with the time value of money for 2 years, because it's not inexpensive. If you ever seen those operations, I mean, holy tar, they have engine after engine, and these are not car engines. These are 2,000 horsepower or 3,000 horsepower aircraft engines, and with the sand and everything else. So I think what's going to surprise is I don't think we're going to see the production jump quite as much as everybody expects because of the lack of water, lack of completion crews. And also, I've been told, and I haven't confirmed this data, but some of the wells that are being completed now, we've sort of gone up the learning curve, and the amount of the increase in efficiency that they've experienced 2 or 3 years ago is not there. We're still increasing the well capability, but they're not 10% better than they were a year ago. And that's the story I hear. And that's sort of the underlying, and it'll be interesting. We'll know within the next 6 months or 8 months when we see the production data here, and actually the drilling data too, the completion data, we'll know whether my premise. So that's very bullish. I mean, that's really bullish, because that's the Permian Basin is really one of the few areas where there's an incremental positive out there. You know, I can say everything else is incremental negative. Iran, Venezuela, you mentioned all the other problem areas. OPEC is, you know, essentially keeping the screws tied so the wheels aren't falling off. So it looks like OPEC's going to play ball, which they should, because they'll get a higher price and everybody will be better off. I'm relatively optimistic that I don't think we're going to go a lot below 60 unless there's a severe economic trade war or recession. And going forward, I can't see anything skyrocketing either, but I can see, you know, a good $70 barrel oil for West Texas, $75 for Brent. I mean, it will make everything profitable. And I think if you see that, I think you know, as gold prices go up, people buy. As oil prices get up to the $70 range, I think you're going to see a lot more transactions.
Yeah, I want to talk about another figure. I mean, the oil markets, traders move a lot on oil inventories. And, you know, one of the things that I learned early on from the late Matt Simmons, he said, look, these are estimates. These are computer models. These aren't somebody out there with the dipstick dipping it into the wells. These are estimates. But one figure that I look at, Joe, and I got this from research analyst at Raymond James, he looks at days inventory use. So you take the amount that we have in inventory and how many days of use of oil does that inventory buy you? And the number of days of use of oil in inventory has been dropping for 5 years. So the media focuses every day or every week on the inventory numbers, but the days of use is declining. And to me, that is a more significant number. I wonder why we don't hear much more about it because that can tell you whether you're going to have bottlenecks or not.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Raymond James does excellent work. And I do know, as we talked about, oil, the use of oil demand goes up year after year. So if you have a tank full of oil, obviously it will not be as preventive of shortages if your growth, and again, it's a 1% or 2% per year compounded is pretty substantial. And the days per use, and I have not, I used to look at that all the time, and I really haven't seen the days of use figures lately, but I know they've been trending downward. Although, what bothers me, Jim, is the market itself, of course, this is where you make money, is where you see something where other people don't. The market has tended to ignore the days of use, although quite frankly, it's probably a much better measure of the health of the oil markets than just the XYZ barrels in inventory that you hear. And as the other thing that drives you crazy is you get these estimates and you get the weekly numbers and the oil jumps up or jumps down 50 cents or a dollar, and you see the headlines, oil inventory is jumping, and you have to sort of take a trend line there because the numbers are, like you say, number one, estimates, and number two, they get adjusted. And I've seen a number of reports too dealing with just how accurate all that stuff is, and it's difficult. But I'm relatively optimistic going forward, and actually reading a number of analyst reports, the people I talk to, I'm optimistic to begin with, because I'm a big investor in the sector. But they going forward for the next 6 months to a year, most people think, again, we've 60 will or 55 might be the low end, but we'll be heading upward. Not spiking, thank God, because you don't want to spike, because then you have all sorts of dislocations. But if we can gently move forward, and again, the interesting thing on all this, just from a theory standpoint, because I have all these, actually the business students who are sophomores and juniors and the law students who most of which have never, don't have a clue on how you value things. You show them a cash flow model and you use one of the dynamic models and you put in $50 a barrel and the properties are worth zero. I mean, this is a hypothetical. And then you put in $65 a barrel and the properties are worth $100 million. And you just go, as a business person or a lawyer, when you structure these deals, you just got to be aware of the volatility of crude oil, and you need a certain price at which your operations can become wildly positive. Or if you want to reduce the risk, you go into the future markets and can do all sorts of financial transactions that generally will lower your return, but you'll lock in your profit, especially if you have a financier or a bank that wants to make sure they get paid back. They'll make you lock in those future. And the decline curves, the other thing, interesting thing, and this is another surprise that is going to come up on it, it's a positive surprise, is the parent-child issue, where you have the first well drilled comes in and everybody thinks the second, third, fourth well is going to be identical. Well, the decline curves have been much less impressive than the first well. And so they call it the child well. Your child is underperforming. And I talked to the Wall Street Journal reporters about this several months ago, and they actually had a front page article on it about a month ago and talked all about the issues we discussed. That when you go and you buy properties, and like if you're Chevron or whoever if you're developing properties and you have 100 of them to develop, you use estimates as to what they're going to produce. And if you're a little bit optimistic, you're using the parent well decline curve, and that isn't what you get. The difference can be substantial in both volumes as well as just economic values. That's another positive implication. And I think it'll be a surprise, because a lot of people, when I walk down the street, people who are not actively involved as much as you or I, they all just think, you got the West Texas and you just turned the valve and there'll just be a flood of oil. And that is true to a certain extent, but it takes years, it takes technology. And if we end up being short for a year or two while we're trying to figure things out here, the prices could be a lot healthier than a lot of people expect.
Well, it's interesting, Joe. If you take a look at the energy sector over the last 2 years, it's been a big underperformer. But behind that is also a lot of the thinking on Wall Street. You got guys that have no idea. They don't have boots on the ground. You know, when we do oil analysis, I talk to people that are, you know, guys like you that boots on the ground, you've been to the wells, you know, you look at the day's use figures, things like that. So I'm in the optimistic camp because, like you, I think too many people like your students have come in and thinking, oh, in 10 years, we're all going to be driving electric cars, oil's going to go away, and I don't know, planes are going to be flying on solar panels. I just don't see it. And at least for at least the next decade or two, we're still going to be in the oil age. The good thing about it from an investor, I don't care if you're looking at some of the bigger mid-tiered companies or the large international integrated companies, Joe, the dividend yields are 4 to 6%. So you're getting twice what you would get in a 30-year treasury for waiting and being patient on top of that. I mean, you even have guys like Exxon and Chevron. I mean, Exxon just increased its dividend 6%. Chevron's increasing its dividend. I don't know too many people that are getting 6, 7, 8% pay increases these days. So if you're an investor and patient, you're certainly rewarded. Joe, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow the work that you guys do a lot of research at the McGuire Energy Institute. How could they do so?
Yeah, they could just look up, just Google SMU McGuire Energy Institute. And I agree with you, Jim. You're getting a return on an asset-backed security. You're not, there is oil, there is gas in the ground. So your premise, I agree with 100%. But I'd love if they have an interest in the SMU McGuire Institute. Google my name, Google SMU McGuire Institute, and I'd love to hear from people.
Okay, you take care, my friend. Bye-bye.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
I actually think that there's some strong evidence that we are entering into a crypto spring and a new bull market. We have gone up over 80% in value since Bitcoin's low in the trough at $3,125 in December. So now we're close to $6,000. We actually passed $6,000 today. And this is a huge price increase. I mean, Bitcoin is very volatile, but an 80% move is something to take a look at, actually. And I think there's actually two main factors driving this. And therefore, I don't think it's only speculation. I think there are actual variables behind this that are causally related to this price movement.
Well, after hitting record after record in just about every single index, we've seen stocks pull back, worries over trade war, and also Fed governors coming out and saying, well, maybe we might raise interest rates one more time. What does this mean for the market? Joining me from Asbury Research is John Kosar. John, let's begin with the market, because last time I had you on the show, I think we were somewhere in the neighborhood around 2,600, and all of a sudden we shot up to the 2,900 levels. So what's your take on what stocks are doing now? Is this a pause, a correction? And longer term, what is this going to mean for investors?
Near term, it's certainly an inflection point. Specifically, I'm looking at S&P 2860, which we bounced off of yesterday. So basically, I follow six market internals. We call them the Asbury Six. I look at them every day. I post them to our website every day because it lets me know, it lets me show my subscribers what's happening under the hood of the stock market. It's stuff like high yield corporate bond spreads and ETF asset flows. And we have a breadth metric in there. Those had been really solidly positive since April 1st. Then last week, I saw that they started to deteriorate a little bit, even as the stock market was going higher. And the S&P edged above its old high at 2941. And the NDX, the NASDAQ 100, you know, kind of led us here, which is what you want to see in a healthy bull market. You want to see tech lead, ideally tech and small cap. But over the weekend, we obviously had the situation with the potential trade war with China. And those internals were already softening up at last week. So then you had the news over the weekend, and we got hit. Right now, we've had a small pullback, but I think 2860 is the level you need to watch in the S&P 500. If it breaks there, I think we see at least 2800 and possibly more. The reason I say possibly more is because we're in the 10th year of a bull market. As everybody knows, the average length of a U.S. bull market is 4.5 years, and we're in year 10. You know, we've also have a flattening yield curve. There's a lot of global politics going on, populism around the globe. There's just a lot of angst right now. So bigger picture, however, if we hold 2860, I've got existing chart patterns in a number of indexes, both here and overseas. One that's more noteworthy than some of the others maybe is the Dow Transports. I've got that going another 15% higher from where we are. We break 2860. That's where we're starting to take a little risk off. We're suggesting clients take a little risk off and prepare for at least the move down to 2800 in the S&P 500. If we can hold here, these lows we're making this week could very well be a bottom that takes us to the next leg higher.
All right, let me ask you this. You and I are doing this interview on a Wednesday, and the trade negotiations are still up in the air, and the tariffs, the 25% tariffs, are supposed to be imposed on Friday. If nothing is resolved, unless Trump tweets that we've got an extension, what if we do have those 25% tariffs imposed on Friday? What might this mean for the market?
Well, like I said before, when the market is at a near-term inflection point, and the S&P is at one of those places now, at 2860, and you see market internals starting to weaken. Generally speaking, the next major event is what's going to help you resolve that inflection point, either up or down. If the news comes out Friday, I mean, really, frankly, who knows? With the current administration, every tweet is something different. So I think trying to trade off of what you think the next tactic or whatever you want to call it, you know, that goes out over the internet is going to be is folly. It isn't a good idea. I watch the data. And I know when the market is at a place where it's likely to start its next move up or down, and then I really kind of keep my ear to the track consistently until that changes. So that's kind of where we're at. I mean, I think whatever the news comes out on Friday, it's probably going to help push, you know, the market either back down to 2800, or it could be the launching pad for the next move to fresh highs. There's no way of telling. There's no way of telling how this is going to be resolved. A lot of this is showmanship and threats. And so it's really, you know, trying to trade off of this, I just think is not the right way to go.
Yeah. And the other thing that I just think longer term, the president is running for re-election. And I think the last thing he would want is a serious trade war carried into next year's election, which could hurt pricing, which could hurt the economy. So a lot of this could be posturing and just short-term noise. I just any guy that wants to get reelected knows it's the economy, stupid. And if we're in a recession and a bear market come November of 2020, that's not going to be good for anybody that's in the White House. So I want to move on to another market that it's just taken off like a rocket since the beginning of the year, and that's been the price of oil. And recently, it hit $66 on WTI. We were in the mid-70s on Brent, and then all of a sudden, we've had a sharp pullback. So what are you reading in terms of fund flows? What are the commercials doing when it comes to oil?
Commercials are really in a place that I would call not very important right now. I'm actually going to the chart because I knew you were going to ask about it. Actually, as I look at this, I take that back. You know, the commercials are historically pretty net short right now. And I'm looking at the large and the small speculators who tend to be trend followers, and thus they tend to be wrong at the turns. They are not as net positive, net long as they've been historically, but they're up in that, I'd say the upper quartile, you know, or maybe the top 20%. So the COT data is actually set for the market to peak and actually roll down. Now, that being said, one of the calls that, you know, we made here early in the year was for oil prices to rise by about 15 to 20%. You know, we put this out in January. And the reason that I was focusing on oil is you don't hear it talked about, but crude oil and the S&P 500 have had a tight positive correlation with each other for the past 2 years and at various intervals inside of that 2 years. So when I was kind of scratching my chin and figuring out in January if this was the start of a bear market in stocks or if it was a place to buy, I was looking for under every rock to try to find another asset that I could lean on, and oil was one of those assets. So to make a long story short, we've hit all of my upside targets that I've had. And now you've got very frothy investor sentiment, and you've got negative seasonality for oil. So our feeling is oil is peaked for now, and I think I would expect oil to be under pressure maybe for the rest of the quarter. I don't see any opportunity to buy oil here. And if anything, I think I'd be selling rallies.
And so your upside targets were reached. What are your downside targets from what the charts are telling you now?
I don't really have any per se. I mean, I think there aren't any patterns per se here, but I'm looking at about $62 a barrel in the nearby futures contract. That's where the market really needs to hold if it's going to continue going higher. I already said the data suggests that it won't. I would say if we get through $62 a barrel, our next level here that I would be looking for is about $56, $50, $57. So I think there's another $4 or $5 at least on the downside here.
Now, let's move to another market. And I want to talk specifically about some of the S&P sectors. John, if we look at some of those S&P sectors from the beginning of the year, it was kind of like who wasn't going up? You know, staples were going up. Consumer discretionary was going up. Just about everything was going up. And you even had, and I think this, you and I discussed this the last time on your show, we had REITs going up, we had utilities going up, you had consumer staples, and I think that was more of a play on yield with the 10-year pulling back. So now we have the 10-year pulling back, we're down below 2.5%, but utilities have been going sideways for the last couple of weeks. What's going on with the utilities as you look at those charts?
You're right. It has been going sideways for some time, and sideways markets are hard to predict, frankly. It's been kind of drifting sideways here since March. So that tells us one thing. Usually when you have a sideways move for several months, especially after a pretty good move higher since the end of the year, I'm looking at XLU right now, which is the spider, you know, for the utilities, and spider ETF. Typically, these little sideways kind of rectangular patterns are the springboard for the next move. What I'm looking for over the next, for the rest of the quarter, I think we're going to see higher interest rates. I actually think the yield of the 10-year is going to move back towards that 280 to 290 area. If that happens, we're probably likely to see XLU fall from here because as treasuries start to yield more, people tend to push their money, you know, yield-seeking investors are going to push their money there and out of, you know, because they don't feel like they have to take the extra credit risk to, you know, to make a bet on the utility sector. So my call on utilities here is more has to do with where I think interest rates are going. And I think we're going to take a run back towards 3% here sometime during the summer.
That's pretty significant because if you take a look at where we've been since the beginning of the year, you know, we were at almost 3.25 as we closed out 2018, and it's been a steep drop and then a stair step down. It bounced back up, and now we're going down again. So from here to go up to do you see that going that way towards the end of the year? Because we had one or two Fed governors come out that surprised the market this week, and they said, oh, by the way, we may have to raise one more time. In the markets, at least in the futures market, was betting that, you know, we were going to see a rate cut. So higher interest rates towards the end of the year, that implies almost something different.
It does. But I try to look at the data and not try to make a bond market call based on whatever the latest Fed governor says, because oftentimes, there's a timing component in there too. So I'm keyed in on what I expect for the next quarter. And that's what we're looking at. There's a number of different indicators that I'm looking at. And one that you might find interesting, because I know you like the COT data, is the retail contingent is currently net long about 33,000 contracts in the 30-year T-bond contract. The past four times that they were that net long was July of 2012, Feb of 2015, July of 2016, and September of 2017. Each of those was an important top in the 30-year, which meant the price of the 30-year went down and the price of the yield went up. That's exactly where we are right now. There's some other data-driven metrics that I'm looking at. That's one that sticks out to me that is kind of a fade. Whenever you get the trend-following retail guys are really on one side of a trade, as they are here, within the next month or two, you usually get a move the other way, and that would drive the price of the bond down and the price of the yield up. And incidentally, if that happened, logically to me, that would also coincide or dovetail with a stronger stock market, taking money back out of treasuries, pushing it into the stock market. So those three things, to me, they fit together, you know, and again, this is probably looking forward 2 to 3 months.
Well, that's kind of interesting, because interest rates going up and stocks going up along with it, it's something like we've seen, like as you mentioned, you look at oil and you look at the S&P and the two have been correlated. Are you finding the same correlation between rising interest rates and stocks?
No, there hasn't been a correlation there for, I want to say, probably more than a year. What I have seen is when there's fear that economy is slowing down, global economy, you know, there's not enough inflation, you know, what's going to take us to the next level? Sometimes you look at the bond market kind of as a leading indication of that. And if the bond market is pricing in, and again, I mean, if we go back to 280 or 290 in the 10-year, that's still a very low, you know, long-term interest rate historically. But that would be an indication that the bond market sees this strength we've had as being sustainable, you know, where rates can rise a little bit, you know, not enough to choke the market off, but just to show that the bond market feels the economy is strong enough to be able to support a little higher rate. And that's kind of where I'm going there. Not anything that's going to throw a wet blanket, but more something that's a blessing from the bond market that they're not as concerned about an upcoming slowdown, as some may think.
You know, what's interesting, John, is the futures market has been pricing in rate cuts by the end of the year. And when anybody is in, we talk about this on the show quite frequently, when everybody's on one side of the boat expecting something, that's usually when something in the opposite direction occurs. So your jump in interest rates might surprise a lot of people in the market who are betting that rates fall.
That's why I like the call so much. It makes me nervous when I look at all of my data and I'm thinking the same thing as the guy on CNBC. That makes me feel like I may need to go back and take a look at everything again, you know, because especially the way the bond market trades, you know, the bond market will sit quiet, you know, in a 10 basis point kind of a range for a month or 6 weeks or sometimes even longer than that. And then within a couple of weeks, it'll move 30 bips. And that's so I think contrary ideas, especially when you're looking at the bond market, those are the ones I tend to like the most because of just because I don't want to be, again, I don't want to be with the crowd. I like to see something that looks a little contrary to the crowd. And two, just, you know, because of the way the bond market trades and a lot of these ideas, they happen so fast. If you don't see them coming, they're gone before you can really participate sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, just take a look at what happened at the beginning of the year after hitting lows in oil, the stock market, December 24th. I mean, it was just like a NASA space launch right afterwards. It happened. That also happened quickly. Finally, a market I want to touch upon, and let's talk about both of them, and that's the dollar, which had been rising. It's pulling back now in the price of gold. Gold tried to take out that 1350 level. It couldn't hold, and it's been stair-stepping down. So what's your take on gold here?
We had been short gold. I actually knew that you were going to ask about gold. So I had pulled up the last report that we did on precious metals was back on April 17th, entitled Emerging Breakdowns in the Miners, warned of an 8% to 9% decline. Looking at some of the targets I had, SLVP is the silver miners ETF. We had an $8 target there. I think it got down to 803, and now it's been kind of oscillating sideways to a bit higher since then. XAU, which is the Philex Gold and Silver Index, XAU. We had a 6750 target there. We got reasonably close to that target. We didn't hit it, but we got awfully close. And GDX was the third. We had a breakdown here right around mid-April. I had a 9% target down to 1980. We didn't quite get there, but we're close. My feeling on those is we've satisfied those targets. And now I'm just kind of sitting back and waiting for the next pattern to emerge or the next change in the flows in the ETF data, flows that go into GDX and GLD. So kind of where we are there is we've just satisfied targets down, and I'm really waiting for the next move. I don't have a lot of directional bias at this time. I would assume over the next few weeks, as you know, typically after you hit targets, you know, the market will drift sideways for a while, and oftentimes another pattern or another trend change will emerge. And we're not at that stage yet. So I don't have a strong feeling about that right now.
Summing up, John, given what you see right now, you see interest rates heading higher as we get into this quarter. And along with it, you could possibly see higher stock prices. So from an investor who's listening to the show, what would your advice be to them in terms of positioning?
I think if you're an aggressive investor that has money on the sidelines, again, this is a little bit of a daring play because of what you were talking about. We're supposed to have a deal with China in place by the end of the week. There's a lot of noise going back and forth, and it's hard to really determine what's going on there. But strictly from a risk-reward standpoint, 2860, I think if you have some money to put to work and you're an agile trader, agile investor that doesn't mind putting an idea out there and having it fail and taking it off for us, you know, for a few percent points of loss, I think you could lean on 2860 in the S&P 500. If we break there, I think we're going to 2800. Bigger picture, if 2860 holds, again, I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 different U.S. indexes that are suggesting to me, bigger picture, we've got another 12 to 20% to go on the upside. So I look at this from strictly risk reward. I'm going to risk 2860 in the S&P 500 for a potential 10% move higher over time. I'll do that all day. Since I can't see the future, when I get that kind of risk-reward ratio, I think that's something to look at. If we go through 2860 and the internals continue to, you know, start to bleed as they have been, then I think you may want to take a little risk off and wait for the smoke to clear. So, I mean, I really kind of see 2860 as a price fulcrum here for SPX.
Okay, so if I wanted to play that, so you got two possible targets here. 2860, if that holds, it's possible going higher. Or if it doesn't hold, it's probably going down to 2800. From a spread point of view, how could you play that?
Well, I wouldn't play the short, frankly. I mean, I don't see enough evidence right now where I would want to be short the market. I would want to take off some risk, but I wouldn't want to be short. So the way that I would do this, you know, as an investor, not somebody who's trading this every day, but our clients are investors. You know, they're looking to put something on tactically from kind of a monthly standpoint, you know, and holding an idea for 1 to several quarters. If you've got some money to put to work, I think you can put some money to work right here and use that 2860 area as kind of a soft stop. Again, there's more to it than just price. I'm probably looking at 20 indicators here. So how we are advising clients is a little more sophisticated. There's a little more information that we can make. We could sharpen our pencils a little bit, but just, you know, for an interview like this that's going to be on the air for the next month, I'd say watch activity around 2860. If we can't hold that, investors may consider, this is what we're telling our clients, you know, to consider mitigating some risk. But if this holds, this 2860 holds, this could be the springboard that takes us to, you know, to new all-time highs later on in the year. So, you know, the risk reward here is very good. I can't see the future. I don't have a crystal ball, but the risk reward looks good.
All right. Well, listen, John, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow the work that you guys do at Asbury Research, how could they follow you?
The best thing to probably do is visit the website, asburyresearch.com, and go to the contact tab. Give us your name and your email address and your phone number if you like. With the email address, we will send you a couple of current sample reports so you can get an idea of kind of what we do and what we offer. We have different services available for different types of investors, but we do work with individual investors as well. So we'd be happy to give you a couple of samples and show you what we do.
All right. Well, John, thanks for coming on the program. And once again, for our listeners, watch that 2860 figure. John, all the best to you and have a great weekend.
Jim, it's always fun. Have a nice couple months and we'll see you soon.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.